From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on January 18th in the pages of the New York Times. Here was the headline regarding Donald Trump's selection for the next Secretary of Energy. Learning curve as Rick Perry pursues a job he initially misunderstood. While the piece portrayed Rick Perry as kind of bumbling, initially unaware of the massive responsibilities of his next job, and here's how the piece opened. Quote, when President-elect Donald J. Trump offered Rick Perry the job of Energy Secretary 5 weeks ago, Mr. Perry gladly accepted, believing he was taking on a role as a global ambassador for the American oil and gas industry that he had long championed in his home state. In the days after, Mr. Perry, the former Texas governor, discovered that he would be no such thing, that in fact, if confirmed by the Senate, he would become the steward of a vast national security complex he knew almost nothing about, caring for the most fearsome weapons on the planet, the United States nuclear arsenal, end quote. Well, almost immediately, the piece spread like a nuclear blast. That's a bad analogy. But the reaction was swift, with many people, many reporters saying that Perry's lack of knowledge was a big concern, frightening even. But the piece relied almost entirely on anonymous sources. In the days that followed, critics blasted the story as being flimsy, with no evidence to support the headlines and the claims. In a statement to Politico, the New York Times said, quote, we stand by our story, which accurately reflected what multiple high-level sources told our reporters, end quote. So let's talk about anonymous sources. How many sources does a reporter need before feeling comfortable that the information is accurate? When should we draw the line on anonymous sources? How can we be certain that a source isn't just unloading against an enemy, knowing they don't have to attach a name? There's not a single standard for how newsrooms handle this. In the age of Trump, there might be more temptation to rely on anonymous sources. But should we? And when we use them, what responsibility do we have to make sure our readers and listeners understand our standards? My guests include Gary Craig, who's a reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, who's known an anonymous source or two in his day. Nice to see you, Gary.
One or two.
I don't think I've ever been a source for you, by the way, I'm happy to say.
Well, if you have been, I'm not going to admit to it.
Yes, don't burn me, please. Nyland Lovelace is a reporter for Open Mic Rochester. Nyland, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
And Melissa Balmain is a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, and dozens of other newspapers and magazines, and she teaches journalism at the University of Rochester. Melissa, coughing, welcome to you. If you cough this hour, it's no problem. We'll hose down the microphone.
I will do my best not to infect you.
You're hanging in there.
Yes, I am.
Melissa, you read the piece in the New York Times on Rick Perry. What did you think in terms of, an initial read? Did that feel like it was explained well enough that it felt credible? Any issues with it?
Well, initially, I did not have qualms about it. But then when I read later that, perhaps some of the sources hadn't been fully vetted, I was a little more concerned. I was, what also happened was the main source on the story kind of backtracked or said that he had been misunderstood. That's a separate issue. But when you've got one main named source and everyone else is unnamed, I think it's a little tricky. And there are a lot of remedies that publications can take to help get across the credentials of sources like that, maybe describe them a little more fully for readers, give readers a sense of who they are, what their background is, if they have an axe to grind, put that out there without revealing their name.
I mean, maybe a reporter would feel like the more specific we get about this person's position, the more they might feel identified.
Right. I mean, it's a tricky thing. But it can be done, certainly things like, high level official in the such and such area. I mean, you can be sort of specific without being too specific. I mean, I think more than ever now, anonymous sources may be appealing. The press and the executive branch are not getting along super well right now. So access to official information may be tapering. So in that case, what are you going to do? You have to use anonymous sources, but also try to maintain the public's trust in your publication. One thing some publications do is have what's known as an ombudsman.
Mm-hmm. Which the Times has.
Which the Times has, known as the public editor at the Times. I've worked at papers that had that as well. I worked for a long time for the Orange County Register in California. We had an ombudsman. And you might say, well, the ombud is paid by the newspaper. How can we trust that person to really investigate the practices of the paper? So that was the idea, that They were kind of keeping an eye on how we reporters were doing our jobs, and the public would complain sometimes, and they would say, well, we think that, you know, this story was not well reported, or who is this anonymous source that was quoted, and that kind of thing. And the ombudsman would come back to us and kind of hold our feet to the fire. We were held accountable. And I think that that was a way of helping maintain public trust. I think the public editor, same thing. You know, letting people know, you know, who your sources are as specifically as you can when they're anonymous. And then if you screw up, admit it. Get it out there. After the big Rolling Stone snafu.
Yeah.
They, you know.
I'm assuming you mean the Sabrina Rubin Erdely piece about a rape on campus?
I do mean that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And she was quoted anonymously or by first name, not identified. Her main alleged assailant was never named. And after it turned out that, you know, things didn't really happen as described, they did go to the Columbia Journalism Review and have them investigate. And, you know, they cooperated fully. Does that erase the mistakes that were made? No, but it shows that they're trying to make amends and trying to
sure.
do better.
Okay. I think Nylon made an interesting point before the hour began. We were talking about the Rick Perry piece. And Nylon, you pointed out that with one named source and then no other info on where these allegations about Rick Perry being confused about the job or I didn't know it was managing a nuclear stockpile, those kind of things, you read that piece and felt like, I guess all of this is based on one guy, right?
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, you know, there are ways to allude to there being other sources. If you read over the piece, it really does seem like it was contingent on this one source giving their piece. There's the backtrack after saying, well, we're going to stand by because we did have, you know, high level anonymous sources that weren't specifically, I don't need them to be named specifically. I just need them to be mentioned. I need you to vet them and give me the confidence to believe them. And believe your piece, and that just didn't happen.
Yeah, what Nylon is pointing out is that when the Times got challenged on this, they essentially said, well, look, we've got other sources that you just don't know.
Yeah.
But that, you know, as a reader, you know, yeah. I was like you. I thought, oh, you got one source on the record. I have no idea if you have anything else. And these are massive allegations. We're talking about managing a nuclear stockpile. So at the very least, you want more of a tip to the reader that we have these kind of sources.
Right, because it's definitely portrayed that this was an official source, which at the time when they originally interviewed him, yes, he was. Then it turns out at the time that Rick Perry was even nominated and considered a candidate for the position, he had already left the Trump camp. So they gave us the confidence that we thought we needed to believe them, that this was official, the one person was fine. Maybe they do have other reports that they are drawing on. But then very quickly, it backfired.
Yeah, I agree with that. Gary Craig, what did you make of the Rick Perry piece?
I'm sort of seconding all that's been said here. I do think the piece, the deeper you got into it, even with the anonymous sourcing, seemed to get more balanced. It seemed like they wanted the, you know, the holy you know what sort of at the outset to try to grab the reader. And I think that was a big mistake. And, you know, and it's sort of, you know, the subsequent sort of research looking into that is, I mean, there's other articles, you know, Texas Tribune and others that would make me think that Rick Perry knew full well, you know, that the nuclear arsenal was part of, you know, his responsibility.
Part of the job.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's it just seemed like there was this desire to try to come up with a lead, a start of a story that may have been more captivating in a way, and it seemed like I thought they went a little overboard with it.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that, especially because Rick Perry has a bit of a narrative coming in. The whole oops thing. I mean, I know he's going to be managing the department that he couldn't even remember that he wanted to eliminate. That's kind of funny, right? And there's this idea that, well, maybe he's not a very smart guy. And unfortunately, the New York Times, which doesn't have a lot of credibility with, as Chris Arnotti told us yesterday, the back row kids in this country, Trump voters, rural voters, they see this as, well, you're taking a narrative and you're just trying to pile on and you're not telling us who your sources are. And it looks constructed to, and the more you read into the piece, as Gary says, it seems to soften a little bit, mm-hmm. as opposed to those leads, which is a lot harder, and the headline, which is very hard.
Yeah, so. And the headline even sort of amped up what you had at the start of the story.
You got to be able to deliver on what you're promising in a headline, don't you?
Exactly. Yes. You would hope so.
Yeah. And so, okay. So I think we agree on that there. And listeners, I'll open it up to you as we kind of work our way through this hour as we discuss anonymous sources. I've already done it on Twitter, and I've got a big bunch of feedback already. But I want to know how you feel about reading news stories or listening to news stories that are largely based on anonymous sources. Does that create kind of a discount in your mind? Do you think that, if it's a news organization that you trust, do you say, okay, I trust you, so I'm going to assume the information is good? Or does that change things? You can let us know, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'd like to ask our panelists what their own standards are or if there are organizational standards. And Gary, I'll start with you. At the Democrat and Chronicle, there is kind of a general rule on using anonymous sources.
Yeah, and it's pretty strict as far as our adherence to it. Basically, we need three. I mean, 9 times out of 10, I think I've had a couple stories where maybe two, and they were just so good that we said, okay, we feel fine. And even those three, I mean, we want people, and we don't want one that's told it to the other. That's not two. And we also want people that truly are in the know. I mean, I can tell you, you know, God bless cops, but you know, if they're not part of the investigation, they hear rumors that are just as bad as anybody else in the street. And so just the fact that a cop tells you it's so doesn't mean it's so. So you know, if it's something we're doing about a particular investigation, we really want it, if we're sourcing it, we really want people who, I use investigation because that's a lot of what I do, we really want people who are in the know and not somebody, even if they're in the same building with the people we're talking to, may have just heard a rumor about it.
Okay. And so three sources, it wouldn't mean, as I joked before the hour, Ivanka Trump and Eric Trump and Donnie Trump.
No.
Independent sources.
Yeah. I mean, I can give you, if you want, the example of, you know, the West Webster incident.
Yes.
We...
2010, 11 or something? Christmas Eve.
11.
Of course, many of our listeners, yes. I assume most would remember, but if you didn't, that was the Christmas Eve shooting in which there was fire set, and as firefighters responded to what became multiple house fires, they were shot at. Two were killed, two were injured, and survived, and William Spengler was the shooter. And Gary, what happened with the Democrat and Chronicle in your reporting that day?
Well, that morning, I think, we had the House address where it started, and Megan McDermott, my great colleague, went to our old archives, and, well, first she ran the property records, found out the name, went to our archives, found William Spengler lived at the house and had, you know, killed his grandmother years before with a hammer. So obviously we thought this might be the guy. I went to work kind of confirming it, trying to confirm it with people, and got two, what I would say, very good. One of them, 100%, it's the guy. Another, 95%, but I can't tell you definitively. So I went to Karen Magnuson, and I think she made the right. Of course, I was itching as the reporter. Let's get it out there. But I think she made the right call because you don't want to be wrong with something like that. And we
so
just
you
said,
had two pretty strong
pretty,
sources.
Pretty good sources.
That this was the
very,
guy.
Very good sources.
And the Democrat and the Chronicle said we're still going to wait.
Yeah, and so what we did though once it was announced at the news conference, we had his history and everything ready. And so I think if you look at our web story, like immediately thereafter, we probably had much more detail. But we didn't, we didn't pull, no pun intended, almost pull the trigger. But we were waiting, and I think it's a good call. I think it really just shows because again, if you're going to be wrong, that's something you don't want to be wrong on.
Okay, we'll go around the table, and I want to keep mining this territory of what you do when you've got a source who says I'd rather be off the record. I want to know how you work with them to say, look, we kind of need you on the record here. Melissa, how do you feel about, or what's your experience? Because you've written for The Times, New York, or you've written for magazines, but all these different organizations may have different standards. What's your standard?
They may have, and I have to say up front, I am not an investigative reporter.
Okay, fair.
I've done a few investigative stories. However, I've had the privilege of working with some of the top investigative reporters in the country. They try very, very hard to get people on the record whenever possible. And, there are various ways to convince people. And, yes, I've had the occasional source say, I just want to be on background or, you're not writing this down, are you, or that sort of thing. And, my standards kind of vary depending on how hard the story is, how hard hitting. If this is a story about a fair, it doesn't matter if you're, quoting by name the person who says that clown is scary. But if you I like clowns. But but anyway, so on the other hand, if it's a hard-hitting news story and, something controversial, yes, you've got to try to get people on the record as much as possible. There are tactics. You can say things like, well, we already know this. We just need you to confirm it. I'm not saying whether this is an ethical thing to do or not, but I know that reporters will sometimes do that as a workaround, making it seem that they have more corroboration of something than they actually do. But you can also just say, this is an important story. We need it out there. We're not going to be able to run it without names. This matters to you, you know, if it's someone who cares about this issue. So you can sometimes do that. One tactic is to come back in, and often people find that they're comfortable saying things on the record more than they had realized, you know. You know, you say, well, how about, is it okay to just use this on the record? And pretty soon you've made your way through your whole notebook and it's all on the record. But, you know, there are some people who really are right not to go on the record. They'll lose their jobs. Their lives may be on the line. And I know that's probably for later in the broadcast.
No, that's, I mean, that's certainly, you know, and that may have been the case in the New York Times Rick Perry story.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted more as a reader to understand, who did you talk to for this? Because
mm-hmm.
I don't feel like you delivered on the promise that you gave me with the headline and in the opening graphs.
Right.
And if you're not, then I feel like there's something, unfortunately, that loses credibility for that piece. And then the next time I read from these reporters, I don't want to feel that way.
Right. And that's a whole other issue, is, you know, pressure to make everything sensational. Probably a whole other show for you.
Yeah, sensationalism. Well, let me point to a piece that Open Mic Rock did recently. OpenMicRock.com. If you want to read Nyland and his colleagues' work, they did a really comprehensive review of Mayor Lovely Warren's first term. And when I mean comprehensive, broke it down by different issues, campaign promises versus results, talk to people, different neighborhoods, different levels of government. I mean, I was very impressed by the work you and your colleagues did. And let me also say, Nyland, that in that piece, you had people saying, look, the mayor's done a great job with this. You also had people saying things that were decidedly not very positive about the mayor, and you had them on the record. And you had people saying some things that were pretty strong. And I appreciate that as a reader. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not always easy to get people on both sides of an issue to say, okay, use my name on this.
Right.
Can you take me through, you know, what you do as a reporter to help people understand, we'd like to talk to you, but we'd like to be able to use your name here?
One of the things that is the second at this table is that a lot of people are very comfortable on the record. Just ask them a general question. You know, I can ask someone like, oh, you know, what's your name? Where are you from? And they tend to over-explain. You know, they come in, they say, oh, well, you know, my name's this, you know, I'm from this place, I grew up here. They give you a lot more details than you really ever expect it. But when you come to someone and you give them a very, ask for a very objective kind of explanation for something. So like when we went to do this piece, and we asked people about their opinions of Mayor Warren, we didn't ask them, we didn't say, oh, we're doing this to look at her legacy so we can see what she's done good and how she's changed Rochester. The overall, we were being objective, saying that we want to see how people interpret Mayor Warren in her first term, good or bad. And we didn't direct them towards, we need something good, we need something bad. We just said, what is your really honest opinion about her? And can you give supporting evidence of that? So mm-hmm. one of the things that we really want to do is when we have these sources, we want to vet them out as much as possible. That doesn't mean that we need to go and dig through their lives. We don't really need them to be a high-level mm-hmm. official or anything. We just need someone who can prove their credibility, and we can also prove their credibility. And that's really what we did. When people have negative things to say about Mayor Warren, but they're not just, I hate her and there's no reason, you know, behind it, we don't really go for that. We want someone to say, well, you know, I think she can do better because she made these promises. And then over the years, we see that they didn't really pan out, and there wasn't really any reason for why they didn't pan out.
Or so for example, on social justice, which is important, and you had people speaking very specifically mm-hmm. about the work that they do in social justice and the work or some of the events that have happened. So in other words, it's not a man on the street. I will be very blunt and say, having worked in commercial television news, sometimes the assignment is go out to the nearest parking lot, get three mm-hmm. quick comments, come back, put it on TV, as if it means anything, as if it's a scientific sample. It's one of the worst ways to do faux journalism. You're not trying to do that. You want to be able to explain to your reader, this is why we've quoted this person.
Exactly, because when you have something live or recorded where they actually see a person, sometimes just seeing that person adds credibility to it. When it comes to print, it's very detached. You're reading someone else's words. You don't have a face to put it to. You don't have a name or anything if you don't provide one. And I think that's one of the things I thought, if this piece that we were talking about, Rick Perry, if that was, you know, recorded, if we saw a person say that, you know, if they weren't named or just said, oh, we have someone who in the vicinity, and if we saw their shoe, there would have been a little bit more credibility to it, just saying, oh, there's an actual person who I can attach these words to, where you don't really get that in print, and you have to focus on making sure that you portray that credibility somehow through what you write.
Okay, well, before I start reading some of the great comments we're getting coming in here, let me just ask Gary, who probably has the longest track record at a single publication at this table. Fair. Yeah,
probably so, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And has there ever been a scenario where you're writing a story and you really can't get anybody on the record, or you've got great information that you really think needs to go out there? Do you consider putting an editor's note, or do you want to at least let readers know the standards for why or how you decide to do it? I mean, how important is it to communicate to readers? I know we're not giving you names here, but here are our standards, and this is why you can trust it.
You know, we haven't done that, but you were speaking about this briefly before we started. It's kind of an interesting idea because I don't think we often do. And we don't use a lot of anonymous sources. I mean, there's not that many stories that obviously some we do. And I'm not sure if it's always our standards are well known if you're reading the story. If you read the story, if you realize that we have a pretty diligent standard to do this versus others that don't have the same sort of threshold. So, yeah, it's actually an interesting idea.
I think if I were in charge of the world, and I sometimes wonder why I'm not, but I'm not. You know, I feel like a story that leans on anonymous sourcing to at least deliver the most important information or the most explosive, or to back up a headline, I would put a short paragraph at the end of it. Editor's note, our policy on anonymous sources is XYZ, and here's why. This particular piece, we spoke to three or four people off the record, just that short kind of a note.
It's a great idea.
To let them know. But I don't know that I've ever seen that out there.
Yeah, I don't think I have.
Yeah, people really value transparency. I mean, we see it on, they have like cop shows like The First 48, where the first thing you see on each and every episode is these are real events, or, some may be a little dramatized. Mm-hmm. But it gives you that, like, hey, you may be seeing something that's not totally accurate, or we got information from someone who we can't, show here, or we can't give names to, and it does add that credibility, and it eases my mind a little bit knowing that what I'm going to see, even if it's not all real or not all, 100% proven facts.
Yep, I agree. I mean, when we rail as journalists on a lack of transparency in government, maybe we need to be as transparent as we can with readers and listeners. And Gary directed me this morning to a story that just broke in the overnight hours. And so I'm going to read this. This is what the Daily Beast published. And Gary said, by the way, take a look at this, because a critic on Twitter was saying, everything I just read in the Daily Beast about this is based on no named sources. And this is a pretty explosive headline. Here it is. Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull stands up to, quote, bully Trump. So you've got this tangle, Donald Trump and the Australian Prime Minister hanging up on each other. Big deal. And the critics were saying, do you have a single source you can point to? How do we know? Let me read exactly what the Daily Beast wrote. Quote, President Trump held his most contentious call yet with a supposed ally late Wednesday. During a call with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, reports suggest both men forcefully expressed their views before the call was abruptly ended. According to a report in the Washington Post, Trump blasted his ally for a refugee agreement between the two countries and bragged about his electoral win before ending the conversation nearly 30 minutes early. Sources close to Turnbull told Sky News Australia that the Australian leader hit back when Trump lost his cool. Trump is a bully, and to combat a bully, you need to bully back, insiders said. Turnbull admitted he had spoken, quote, candidly and frankly with Trump. I do stand up for Australia. My job is to defend Australian interests. Trump had reportedly told Turnbull that among the other calls he'd had with world leaders, including Russian President Vladimir Putin that day, quote, this was the worst call by far, end quote. Speaking about a deal for the United States to take in 1,250 refugees from an Australian detention center, Trump allegedly complained that he was, quote, going to get killed politically, and accused Australia of trying to export the next Boston bombers. Trump tweeted late Wednesday, do you believe it? The Obama administration agreed to take thousands of illegal immigrants from Australia. Why? I will study this dumb deal, end quote. So that's the whole story. And let's kind of go through this, and I want to highlight all the different ways they try to say that people said things that they can't say that they actually said. It starts with, reports suggest both men forcefully expressed their views. Then the Daily Beast says, a report in the Washington Post. So they're telling their readers that this, we're taking this from the Washington Post, who took it all from sources close to Turnbull, and then insiders telling them, and then Trump reportedly telling Turnbull, and then Trump allegedly complaining. So... I don't know. What is Gary Craig? What's the difference between a source close to Turnbull and an insider?
I have no clue.
Isn't that sloppy?
I mean, my other problem with, I have a lot of problems with it. Yeah, one of the things too, and you know, and I think a lot of standards, AP standards and others, when you're using anonymous sources, you don't allow name calling with anonymous sources. That's become, you know, don't necessarily try to report on what you think somebody, you know, if there's a name calling, what do you believe they know. Anonymous sources is good for actual acts, the facts that you can prove or disprove. You know, the idea of like anonymously sourcing somebody says Trump is a bully, that to me is just
a waste of time. Exactly. Inflammatory. It's great for clicks and great for headlines.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
But you cannot tell me the difference between a source and an insider. Okay, Melissa, a source and an insider. You think there's supposed to be a difference there?
I think one of them is standing outdoors, and one of
them is an insider and an outsider.
There
yeah.
you go. No, I really, I also have no clue. And yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing that drives readers crazy. And I love your idea of that paragraph of transparency at the end. I think that would be terrific. And I definitely agree with you, Gary, about you know, the kinds of things that we should be getting from anonymous sources, just, you know, insults and so forth. That's not very productive, and it's not really helping readers, and it's not helping the reputation of journalists.
I agree. Nylon, insiders versus sources. What do you think the difference is?
Inside what?
That's what I want to know. Like,
inside
his
house,
voices.
Inside Australia. It's just...
Inside joke?
Yeah, it just seems horribly, horribly inconsistent too, yeah. You know. And I think they kept trying to switch it around, hoping that you would just go over it. And I think they actually drew more attention to themselves than they actually intended to.
Yeah, I agree with the horrible inconsistency. And I wonder if, like, we feel we need to change words sometimes. I think Emily Dickinson had said some things about, you know, reusing the same word. Sometimes it feels tired. A house becomes a residence. Mm-hmm. You know, I get that. But when you're talking about sources, that's an important word for a reader.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, don't change it halfway through because you're tired of saying sources said. For me, that becomes confusing. Are we talking about somebody else here? I would not change it. And so to me, that was very sloppy and deserved the derision that it's getting. But I like the whole inside voices, inside, outside, yes. Standing outside, yes. House. There you go. We're talking about the value of anonymous sources, and there is value of anonymous sources. And there are times where, as Melissa Ballman has pointed out, they're very important to a story, and you can't get information otherwise. We're going to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back to your phone calls, comments, and questions that have come in online. And we'll continue this discussion about whether our panelists feel anything is different now. Is anything different in the age of Trump? Melissa sort of alluded to that earlier, that, you know, there may be more tension, more of a lack of access as this administration seeks to go directly to the public via YouTube, via Twitter, maybe less access for journalists. Is there more of a desire to use anonymous sources? And should we? Melissa Ballman is a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in The New York Times, The New Yorker, many magazines and newspapers, and she teaches journalism at the University of Rochester. Gary Craig is a reporter for The Democrat and Chronicle. Nylon Lovelace, a reporter for Open Mic Rochester. And come back to your comments next. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about the Reshaping Rochester series. Their next speaker comes from Detroit. Now, if you haven't been following along, you might only know that Detroit went through bankruptcy a few years ago and has really struggled. And it has really struggled. But there are some, well, innovative things happening there. And the question is, can Rochester learn from that? So that's our conversation. Join us next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Ingrid in Penfield first on the phones. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm starting to feel like a stalker. I'm pretty annoyed about the way you guys just handled this story from Australia. But I'm wondering what you think about it. If I had just come in and heard you talking about it, I would think that you were utterly scornful of the idea that this conversation happened. I don't think you meant that, but I'm wondering what you did mean.
Okay, so hold on, Ingrid. I think that you're making an important point here. First of all, Donald Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast this morning acknowledged that he had a, quote, tough phone call with Australia, and Senator John McCain felt compelled enough to reiterate his support between, let's see here, McCain said, quote, I called Australia's ambassador to the United States this morning to express my unwavering support for the U.S.-Australia alliance, end quote. That wouldn't happen if there wasn't an uncomfortable phone call. I think it's pretty clear there was, but that doesn't mean that you can just say that these things happened if you don't have sources on the record or if you just want to put out there that they were name-calling. So I think the point you're making is it's important to know. If we're fraying our relationships with allies, that can be important. But what we're kind of...
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if there's a source, that source is putting him or herself at great risk to get this stuff out. And I'm very grateful if that's what's happening.
Yes, Gary Craig. Stay on the line, Ingrid. Gary Craig.
Sure. I fully understand what you're saying. And the conversation, the Twitter conversation that I forwarded to Evan this morning about this sort of got into this. I don't disagree that this is a story and it should be reported. It's just the initial reporting on it, the sourcing seems so lackluster, and it got confirmed by others as the day went on. And the point that sort of this Twitter conversation was, couldn't you have waited until you had more substantial sourcing, which did come later on in the day? And that, to me, was the problem with some of the initial conversations. Coverage is that the sourcing to me just seemed somewhat thin. And as the day progressed, there became more support to substantiate this story.
That makes sense,
Ingrid? That has been happening lately. And I think what's happening is that some people are getting it first. And I am not sure that they are to be distrusted. I'm very grateful to them.
Listen,
I think you're talking at a high level. You're talking amongst your colleagues. You're talking about journalistic standards, and that's wonderful. For the person on the street, I hope you'll be careful. That's all I wanted to say. Thanks so much.
Ingrid, thanks for the phone call. I mean, I think the whole point is to be careful enough so journalists don't lose credibility. Right now, I mean, Ingrid, what you're saying is these reporters are talking to high-level sources and putting important information out there, and we need that, and we do need that. I think everybody in this room agrees with that, and I hope you agree with that. There are plenty of Americans who don't trust the mainstream media, tens of millions, we know that, and when you've got stories out there that say the prime minister called Trump a bully without a source, to Gary Craig's point, just throwing pejoratives out there, that's not real news. To me, if you think this is important enough to report without actual on-the-record sources, and by the way, a phone call between two leaders, it's probably going to get out what happened. But if you want to get out there first with it, don't put a headline that says the prime minister called Trump a bully. Say high-level sources say that American president cuts off phone call with Australia prime minister, potentially fraying relationship. That's important. That's the information, not, oh, they're name calling. It got a little ugly. You know, give me why this matters. This is not a Jerry Springer episode where this guy's a bully and the crowd's chanting. This is a diplomatic and relationship and an alliance that matters. That, to me, is the problem. When you've got headlines that are so sensationalistic and we're going to be first and I don't care what it looks like, we're just going to get this out there. That was my complaint with it. So anybody want to add anything before we go on here? Melissa?
I second what you said. This is about maintaining trust between the press and readers and listeners and, you know, yes, it's very important to get these stories out there, but it's not so great if they come out and then have to be retracted or tweaked, and then the public ends up wondering, well, what can we trust? As journalists, it's really, really important to maintain that trust.
Okay. Nyland?
I think if these stories start boiling down to he said, she said, which the initial piece, that's what it was. It just sounded like he said, she said, there was nothing backing it up. I think you're going to get to the point where, yeah, no one's going to trust what's gets put out there, because I can do he said, she said on the street and just take whatever I hear as truth.
Okay. Let's get back to your phone calls on that subject. Mike in Rochester next. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, I was just listening to your program, and I just think you're playing right into the narrative of this particular administration. And I think the better way to look at this is how many times a publication, institution, retracts a story or makes a correction for a mistake that they made. You know, when this executive order about the Muslim ban came out, Fox News reported that, I'm sorry about the shooting in Montreal, Fox News reported that the guy was, he was a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't pull that down until Justin Trudeau came out and basically pleaded to the president of Fox News to pull that story down. Now, that is propaganda. That is fake news. Fox is fake news for doing that. When the New York Times does a story and they have a correction, they will always print the correction. Always print the correction in digital format and in other places. I just think that this is, you know, this whole thing about the media being not trusted is absolutely not true. True journalists take their job very, very seriously.
That is absolutely right, Mike. But again, we may be looking at a little bit of a bubble syndrome, and I'm not trying to attack you. I've been there myself, right? I want to believe that people trust the media. They trust NPR. They trust WXXI. They trust the Democrat and Chronicle, Open Mic, all these great sources that we have. But we know that tens of millions don't. Listen to Chris Arnotti, who was on the show yesterday. He spends his life in these communities where people just don't. They look for the media to get outraged at Trump, and they think that proves that Trump was right.
But the reason for that is that you have got a nonstop disinformation machine that is that is talk radio, that is Rush Limbaugh, that is Alex Jones, that's the Breitbart, that's the constant stream, and then all the other ones that come around come about it. Type of negative, that people will start to believe the negativity before they start,
Mike, I'm not disagreeing with you on that. I'm just saying the media, the mainstream media, the sources that you trust must be right. This is such a sensitive time that you can't give ammunition that this is a biased media or a sloppy media. And when you do, that gets exploited to no end. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, CNN, I think, is probably the most balanced and the most fair, and they disclosed what the transcripts were for the conversation between the prime minister of
Australia
and what the president said. It showed it right there. You know, so there doesn't need to be, he said, she said. Of course there's a lot of people that say that. Especially right now when everybody's job is at risk.
Mike, I want to thank you for the call. I think it was Nyland who said earlier, the initial reports were a he said, she said. And Mike's making the point, Nyland, that, well, CNN released the transcript. Well, if it was going to come out eventually, why are the initial reports relying on he said, she said, right?
Exactly. If CNN could release the transcripts, who else could have released the transcript? The very people who published it first, and at least saying transcripts coming soon, maybe, you know, something like that. But basically what he's saying right now is that you can't trust certain sources because they're just continuously playing to this bias. One, almost all media is biased in some way. But two, you have to stop and think. The reason that people don't trust mainstream media is just these instances where people come out and they do the he said, she said, because they just want to be first. They don't want to be the most accurate. They don't want to be the most informative. They just want to be the first one to have their name attached to it.
Okay. Melissa, what do you think of Mike's concern about, are we playing into the administration's hands with this?
I don't think so. I think we're fighting for a press that will be trusted and that will get as much access as we're allowed to get. We need to vet our anonymous sources as well as we can, but we do need our anonymous sources. Historically, many important stories have depended on anonymous sources, and I would never suggest that we don't need them. I mean, dating all the way back to Deep Throat and beyond, you know, for the Watergate stories, many, many investigative kind of stories, prison treatment. There's been a recent series in the New York Times on that. Those kinds of stories, I don't know about their sourcing there, how many of their sources were anonymous, but inevitably a story like that will depend on some brave people to come forward. And we need that. Sometimes it's been suggested, like I think USA Today has reduced its use of unnamed sources. And I found a quote from The New Yorker's David Remnick saying that, how many national security stories has USA Today broken? So without some anonymous stories, sources, you're not going to get the hard-hitting stories that we really need.
Yeah, here's Matt on Twitter saying, I don't like anonymous sources at all, but I must remember that Deep Throat was anonymous and started the fall of a corrupt president. That's from Matt. Gary, what do you make of Mike's phone call?
I think you hit the nail on the head. If there's the need for anonymous sources. You mentioned Deep Throat, obviously. But right now, you talked about narrative. The narrative right now is that the mainstream media is, sort of adversarial, maybe too mild a word, with the current administration. And any error or any misstep that is made by, quote, the mainstream media is going to be basically amplified and becomes part of the propaganda and part of that narrative. I mean, I've already forgotten who it was that misreported that the Martin Luther King bust was taken down out of the White House.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that they got a lot of mileage out of that. And there was a quick apology. There was a quick correction. But it became evident that, they're just looking for ways to get their claws into the administration. I mean, the irony is that, it's such a fact-challenged administration, and we're the ones getting beaten up.
Yeah. Hmm.
Back to the phones. Tim in Pittsford. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Evan. I think Ingrid actually proved your point for you, even though she was trying to argue against it. But when just an average reader or average listener like myself sees anonymous, we think fake, because anonymous means you can't go back and question that person because they're not going to use their name. You're not identifying them. And at that point, I think the reader says, well, this is about as good as something that's in the Wegmans aisle right when you're going to check out. As far as, a magazine, Inquirer or whatever.
But Tim, do you think there's ever a good reason for anonymous sources?
And the funny thing is, Inquirer has actually improved. But I think the thing about it is, with this magical thing called the Internet, it's a race to who's first. And it almost seems like to us out here that if someone isn't first, then they've lost no matter what.
Hmm.
And as far as the media bias, everyone has a bias. I know that, but I think more people just want the facts from journalists laid out like we thought journalism was supposed to be, and then let us make the decision. I think a lot of people do that, and I think most people do that, but laying out the facts and then leading someone toward the conclusion that the journalist wants is where I would hope there is plenty of pushback. And I don't know if that's really journalism. That's more of an opinion piece.
Well, Tim, thank you. I always appreciate the phone call. Doesn't sound like Gary Craig, he ever is going to trust an anonymous source.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stories you're going to miss because of that. I mean, you mentioned Deep Throat is obviously the most prominent one. There's been numerous others through the years. And obviously the Times, the Washington Post, L.A. Times, et cetera. I think their standards are typically pretty good. The Rick Perry story is bothersome, obviously. And I do worry that this new environment where, as you mentioned, the caller mentioned, everybody wanting to be first, could do a lot of damage. Because I think in the aftermath of Jason Blair, he really wasn't – he was more fabulous than a plagiarist for the New York Times,
right.
and Stephen Glass and all. I think there was – with the New Republic. I think media sources started really tightening up and strengthening – their standards. And I do worry that this, because let's face it, there's more news coming out daily right now than we can handle, that this sort of constant flood of news may loosen those standards some.
Nylon, do you think Tim's going too far in saying all anonymous sources to him just sound fake or possibly made up or valueless?
Definitely, but I actually see his point still. If you don't add value or don't validate that source somehow, even with them still being anonymous, there's still that chance that whoever's going to read it won't see any weight in what you're saying. But I also think that what Ingrid proving our point, I think it's the exact opposite, where her point was she thinks that we should use anonymous sources because they could, in certain situations, add validity and they could put out there something that we are completely hidden from. Whereas I think Tim, his point and how he interpreted what she said was that anonymous automatically means fake, when she was saying anonymous may actually be the closest thing to real you may be able to get. And if someone puts their name out on it, it may actually devalue it a little bit.
I think Ingrid made an important point that we hadn't been brought up this hour yet, which is that we at times have had massive stories broken because of anonymous sourcing. Mm-hmm. And everybody does go back to Deep Throat, but there's plenty more.
Mm-hmm.
Abu Ghraib, I think there's a number of others.
Mm-hmm.
And without them, we may not have the chance. If the standard is no anonymous sources ever, well, then we may be in trouble in terms of finding out information. So let me grab Bonnie in Rochester. Wants to jump in? Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I generally agree with most of what has been said. I think anonymous sources you can't avoid, really. You just have to really be careful. But there's a couple other things. I think the media now has to realize, and they probably in their private moments say this, is that there's a real strategy. This is part of a strategy going on with the Trump group there to create as much chaos as you possibly can. And I think if you don't see that, and I don't necessarily have easy answers for it, but I think if you don't see that, then everything becomes, you know, microscopic. You know, and it's, and sometimes, you know, there's sometimes you do that, but sometimes when you do that, you the focus gets so changed on the microscopic. Well, this little piece, that little piece, this little piece, pretty soon it's such chaos, which is what Steve Bannon has been quoted as saying he wants. That's part of his strategy. So I think you have to recognize that, and media has to collectively deal with that. So we're not playing one person against the other. You got the story first, I got the story second. The second thing is, and this is, again, a little on the gray area, is that I notice a lot of times when reporters interview, say, the average citizen, especially the average person who doesn't seem to know much who supports Donald Trump, I realize there's a lot of judgment there. But, you know, people, the reporters, a lot of times when they say something that sounds outlandish or say something that they just, you know, kind of look like they made up, the reporters don't ask them anything. They don't ask them anything to validate the things that they've just said. So that this leads, a lot of times I think people don't want to confront people, and I'm not saying you yell at them, but I think what happens is that just reinforces this whole thing and leaves people, well, what you said must have been true, even though the listener probably knows it doesn't make sense.
Bonnie, I think it's fair points all, and I think you're right about Steve Bannon in terms of, at least as Chris Arnotti said yesterday, wanting to create this chase the rabbit syndrome. There's a lot to distract from the real stories out there. Daniel on Twitter, building on Bonnie's point, he says the reason for the drama via social media with regard to sources is that we have a reality TV star in the White House and they are driving it. And then Daniel adds this, which I think is really astute. He says the difference between Mark Felt and anonymous sources is that Felt actually provided actionable information. Trump slams X isn't of value. Mm-hmm. So Daniel's saying, if you have an anonymous source saying Trump made fun of Theresa May after meeting her, which he didn't, by the way, but let's say you got an anonymous source saying that, who cares?
Exactly.
Where right. What Daniel's saying is Mark Felt was providing actionable information that led to the downfall of an administration that the public needed to know about. That's when anonymous sources have great value, and we have to be very discerning, I think, in how we're using them. So, and real quick here, Marshall in Rochester. Go ahead, Marshall.
I'm just wondering why there couldn't be a byline at the head of every story, one that says anonymous sources and one that says no anonymous sources. That would leave the reader in a good position to decide for him or herself what the value of the story is.
Marshall, thanks. Gary, what do you think?
Hopefully, if you read deep enough in the story, it'll tell you if there's an anonymous source. I'm hoping they get beyond the byline typically. So,
I'm with that. And that's actually, I think Nyland made one of the best points of the hour. Is nowhere in that Rick Perry story early on did I see a really good accounting of where the sources were. So at least at some point, whether it's a byline or at least in the body of the story, which is doable. But there's a lot of people on Twitter essentially saying they have some issues with anonymous sources, but if they trust the outlet, they generally will have the faith that what they're reading or hearing is fair. Ed says, if the reporter news organization has a track record, I'm okay with it. Says New York Times, I'm okay with it. Fox News, of course not. That's Ed's point of view. Tim says it wouldn't matter if there weren't as many mainstream media outlets and journalists serving up outright hoax stories to consumers on a daily basis. I don't know about hoax stories, Tim. I think what we're talking about is what is sloppy or maybe agenda-driven. I mean, Gary said that the narrative is that the media is looking for reasons to go after, and they've got to be careful not to fall into that trap. But I think a lot of you are saying, if I trust you, you know, so... quick thoughts, final thoughts going forward here, Nyland. What have we learned this hour about anonymous sources?
What I learned is, obviously, from some of our callers that people associate anonymous with fake in general, and they don't place their value in the story itself. They just place their value on whether or not anonymous source is used or is not used, which I think can be very detrimental and also lead you to some very bad and possibly fake news.
Yeah, okay. What did we learn this hour, Melissa Balmain?
Well, here's a quote from Donald Rumsfeld. Freedom is untidy, And free people are free to make mistakes, but they're also free to do wonderful things. He was not talking about use of anonymous sources. This was quoted, however, in an article on the use of anonymous sources, and the idea being that sometimes you have to use unusual means.
Okay. Gary Craig, what did we learn?
I think it's good what we're doing right here. You mentioned early transparency and how important it is. I think conversations like this add to that.
Okay. Well, listeners, I would just say we've got three journalists that I respect a great deal at this table. I think a lot of great perspective this hour. And I'm with people who say, I wish we wouldn't see anonymous sources. I wish every source were on the record. But Melissa pointed out, I mean, sometimes jobs are on the line. Sometimes livelihoods are at stake. And this is a bit of a perilous moment, so you might see a little bit more in the way of anonymous sources. And now at least you've got more of a handle on when they should or should not be used. So I just want to thank our panelists for being here. Nylan Lovelace, we'll look for your work in Open Mic Rochester. Nice to see you.
Nice seeing you.
Gary Craig, always good to see you with the Democrat and Chronicle. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks, Evan.
And Melissa Balmain, a freelance journalist. Got anything coming out soon?
Actually, I have a story on trust coming out fairly soon.
I teed that one up. Where's that going?
Success Magazine.
Very good. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it. All right, short break. More connections next.